The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to the PVD Cast with John Orlando.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. Wait a minute. Another installment? That's not accurate. It is episode 500. And for those of you that don't know who I am, allow me to introduce myself. I am your humble host. I am your podcast purveyor. I am the man behind this podcast. I am John Orlando, and welcome to the PVD Cast, episode 500. Now, I hope all of you are well out there, and I do very much thank you for checking out this episode of the PVD Cast. And look, I'm going to be honest with you all. Normally, when I do these intros, I have bullet points on a little post-it note of things to mention, and I don't have a post-it note because I want to speak from the heart. I want to talk about this landmark episode, 500, folks, 500 episodes of this little podcast that I created about 13 years ago. In fact, in December, it will be 13 years. I don't know what more to say other than I am truly proud of this accomplishment. I've worked very hard. I'm totally DIY. I took one weekend class at a community college on podcasting, and then the rest of it was just trial and error. And I really just have to say, thank you. Thank you to everybody who's checked out an episode of the PVD Cast. Thank you to folks who help support this podcast by sharing it out or by being a guest. And I, of course, would be remiss if I didn't thank all of the guests who have appeared on this show. Without you, this show would be just probably me talking about some silliness. Which some of you probably remember when I used to do short episodes, like 20-minute episodes, where it was just me, myself, and I. And I would talk about just whatever was on my mind. And I have to be honest, while those were a neat idea, they didn't really draw in listeners. So, ergo why I stopped doing those. This podcast has changed a little bit from the beginning. I've mentioned before that I was doing one episode a month. And then after about 6 months of that, I jumped to 2 episodes a month. And I did that for a long time until I got to 3 episodes and now up to 4 episodes. And, you know, it's like I said, I'm DIY. It was a work in progress. But, you know, I also got to confess, and I can't believe when I was doing my thank yous, I forgot to mention this. But one of the other cool things that has happened since I've been podcasting is not only have I talked to a lot of cool guests, but some of those guests have become good friends of mine, and I really do appreciate that. And of course, I also forgot to talk about sponsors, and of course, I could not talk about sponsors without talking about World's Greatest Comics. Jeff has been such a wonderful sponsor. I really do appreciate him, and I'm just going to go ahead and do the plug real quick. You know, this episode is brought to you by World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. They have tons of comics from every era, whether you're talking about the golden, silver, bronze, and modern eras. They also have graphic novels, toys, collectibles, comic book supplies, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues. They got you covered for your fandom. So if you want and you're in Central Ohio, stop by the store. Once again, they're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. But you can also check them out online. WGComics.com is their web address, and they're pretty active on the Facebook page. Just search for at WGComics. Oh, drats. I even forgot to mention the most important person that has helped supported this podcast, and that is my wife, Courtney. She has supported me in my podcasting endeavors. throughout our time together, which is 5 years now. So I do appreciate her support. And you know what? I've rambled. I certainly have just kind of gone all over the place, which ought to tell you, I don't have my post-it note. So with that, let's talk about who is going to be my guests on this landmark episode of the PVD cast. Well, I got three good ones. And I won't lie, I threw out a lot of emails to a lot of different people. But I happened to stumble upon three guests just by happenstance, it really was. I was going to the Monroe Comic Con, and these three individuals were there, and they were nice enough to sit down and chat with me in a panel format. So my three guests are none other than the War Machine Rhino, the franchise Shane Douglas, and WWE Hall of Famer Sergeant Slaughter. And so I'm really excited for you to hear this episode, because Sergeant Slaughter, I mean, I was a kid that grew up with G.I. Joes, and he was an integral part of that toy line. And of course, Shane Douglas and Rhino, two big fan favorites, including yours truly, from the days of ECW. And of course, they've also been all around the world in various different companies as well. So Shane, Rhino, and Sarge are going to share their stories and some of their insights and whatnot. Well, as I said, I've rambled quite a bit for this opening. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my conversations with Rhino, the franchise Shane Douglas, and WWE Hall of Famer Sergeant Slaughter. It's just like the steel cage. Just like the steel cage. Well, ladies and gentlemen, these two individuals next to me do not deserve, or does not need to have any. Anyways, they need no introduction. This, of course, is the man beast, Rhino. There you go. And next to him, of course, the franchise, Shane Douglas. So, gentlemen, as I told the folks that were here in the room already, I want them to ask their questions. But I do have a couple to kind of start us off, since Sarge is here, and he, of course, was probably the very first, I would say, wrestler to have some type of a crossover toy with the G.I. Joe figure. And you two have had some action figures created through San Francisco Toys and ECW. Are you kind of really like, are you proud of that fact that you have toys there, Shane?
I am. To me, that was always the bellwether of like making it or not making it. And for an ECW, this might surprise some of you people, Paul Heyman, we get to the building one day and all the equipment is set up with body scan and your face and tattoos and all that. And they took all that, and I thought, well, they'll negotiate with each of us afterwards. And I thought, Robbie Cannon, who's vice president of San Francisco Toys, he and I were real good friends, and I was talking to him at the bar one night, and I said, you know, how'd you get the permission? They started negotiating with the guys, and he said, Paul told us he owns all the names. He didn't know my name, he didn't know the brand. So we could, and I told him, I said, dude, like, your ass is hanging in the wind here. I said, these guys, if somebody, Taz or whoever, you know, or me, anybody, you know, you're taking money off our table. And I told her, I kept that squash down in the dressing room because I knew that the action figures and the idea that ECW had action figures out, that put us in the same universe as the WWE or FN. And so it was like, okay, we didn't make the money off it. We should have. We made no money off of it. But it helved elevate ECW just a little bit more by having them. So, yeah, really cool.
Rhino, did you ever go down the aisle of the toys and go, oh, there's me?
Actually, I would... No, not really.
Short answer. He's got his bedroom, though, every month's aligned with him.
I was actually really fortunate that, you know, they never had a huge run of them. So whenever I would go to a toy store, they were always sold out, you know, because they'd hit the shelves. And whenever you have new action figures hit the shelves, a lot of collectors will go and grab them real quick. And plus, being in the Detroit, Michigan area, a lot of people knew that I was from here, and they would grab them. So it's funny John A. Bravo or Johnny Bravo, he would work at Toys R Us, and my mom would ask him to hold some for it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so he wouldn't hold any for me, correct? But yeah, so
sure, his mother.
It was nice, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome here Hall of Famer, WWE Hall of Famer, and that's all right. No problem.
Over here.
Here, I'll slide down one. Here, you take that. All right.
See, I told you he moves around.
Great. Yeah. Sarge, we were just talking about the fact that, you know, I think the credit belongs to you probably for creating this crossover action figure line between your time in the wrestling ring and the time with G.I. Joe. So when you first got pitched this idea, what were you thinking?
Well, I did the... I guess you would say double cross against the Iron Sheik. I walked out without anybody knowing it, and what we call in our business the element of surprise. I went from 5 minutes earlier being the most hated villain. In about 5 minutes, I declared war on the Iron Sheik and did the Pledge of Allegiance, and everybody stood up, and I guess Hasbro saw that and wanted me to be their first living G.I. Joe. So I went to have a meeting with them. And it was, I never thought I would have an opportunity because they said they had four men that they wanted to have as their first living G.I. Joe. One was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Whoa.
One was Chuck Norris. The other was Sylvester Stallone, and then me. So I figured I might as well just leave the building. there's no way they're going to pick me.
But they
called.
Yeah, they knew Arnold ever beat.
Yeah.
So they finally called about, well, before I left, I told them, if you're looking for the real G.I. Joe, you're looking at him. And so by the time I got back, my attorney and I went up to the Hasbro headquarters, and about halfway back, we didn't have cell phones, and we stopped to have dinner, and he checked his messages, and he said, they want you. They picked you already, and I said, oh, great. So now I had to go tell Vince McMahon that now we got a Sergeant Slaughter wrestler and a Sergeant Slaughter G.I. Joe, and he said, that's great, pal, but I can't let you do it. And I said, why not? He said, because I just signed with LJN, a week ago, and that's our toy company, it'd be a conflict of interest. And I said, LJ who? Yeah. I said, I'm talking Hasbro, the biggest toy, boys toy in the world. He said, good job, pal, but can't do it. So these guys have all heard that from Vince.
Yeah.
Good job, pal. Good job. So anyway, I fought it, and I said, you got to let me do it. I can't do it. You can't do it. If you want to go there, go. If you don't, stay here. And WrestleMania 1 was just starting. It was supposed to be Hogan and I against Orndorff and Piper. That was the goal to be WrestleMania 1. And so he figured I would stay. And just sitting with my wife and children having dinner one night, she said, what is the problem with all this? I said, well, Vince wants me to stay, but he won't let me do G.I. Joe. She said, it's a pretty simple decision. I said, it is? She goes, yeah. You can always be a wrestler. You can't always be the first living G.I. Joe. Wow. So I said, that's why you get the big bucks, honey. And off I went. I told Vince I was leaving, and the war started between the two of us. And eventually, I left and was gone for 6 years.
Okay, if I could ask real quickly, what was the next step, Sarge, after that? Was it like you got to go to Rhode Island to meet in Hasbro, and they sketch things out for you and that? Right. Is that basically what went on?
Right. They put me on a machine, and I went around in a circle. They kept taking pictures, and got as close to the real-looking person because they – never had a real live character, so it didn't matter what the other ones looked like. They were just voices. So.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the way it went.
Anybody have some questions for any of our guests up here? Come on, guys. I said, anything you... Yes, you.
Rhino, what was it like putting over Nick Wayne in your AEW debut?
Oh, actually, he hell of a wrestler, too. Yeah, and just working with Christian and, you know, learning a lot, good head on his shoulders and that whole story. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it and just wish I had a little more time. But he's very talented, and I told him, keep your head on straight and you'll definitely become a world champion one day. So, you know, I think he just turned 19 or something. So I told him, I go, a lot of shit will get thrown at you, you know, in your personal life. So just know how to navigate the waters and don't be afraid, because, you know, sometimes you might go out partying with your buddies and that one night of partying will turn two nights, three nights, and next thing you know, you're like, shit, 6 months has gone by and you've been drunk every day. So, you know, other things will be introduced to you. So just stay focused and stay on track and, you know, don't screw up and just try to learn as much as possible. So, yeah. But I was happy to work with him. So. Better him than Christian, that prick.
All right,
so I'm a young man. Yeah, you've worked with Christian. He's a prick, isn't he? Yeah,
oh, man.
Yeah. You've aged in a few of his matches. No, he's a good
both
dude.
Both in and out.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Stiff, too, in the ring.
It's really,
my only concussion was with Christian. So
it's really good to see like Rhino and Shane, who followed me. We started that Yellow Brick Road. It was started before I was in the business, but they continued to pave it and gave advice, as he just said to one of the talents who was coming up, so that we can all continue this Yellow Brick Road. And what better advice could you give from a couple of pros like that?
If
I could add to that real quick, I mean,
sure.
As Sarge, I'm sure, knows this, for us walking into those dressing rooms, these guys, these heroes we've grown up watching, Andrew, when you're a young kid like that in the business, you're well aware of the fact that you don't know shit, right? You're pretty much a greenhorn. But the intimidation factor of walking into those rooms, but honestly, Sarge, Randy Savage, Jake Roberts, Paul Orndorff, Bobby Heenan, my first night up there, I wrestled first Savage, second was Jake, third was Butch Reed, fourth was Orndorff with Bobby Heenan. I came back, well, first of all, Randy came to before the first match and he said, I know you could imagine, I hear my heart in my ears. This is Randy Savage. Sarge is right there. They're all these giants in our business. And he goes, what can you do, kid? And I wasn't sure I should even open my mouth, because Dominic Tucci said, keep your mouth shut and eyes and ears open. Yeah. And he said, no, like, what kind of moves can you do? And I said, well, I can drop kick. He said, I got it. And he walked away.
What did you say? You could
I can, like, drop kick and I can.
That was the first thing I said. Have you ever watched me wrestle? I've never hit a drop kick. That's started. Why does everybody go, what can you do with drop kick?
And he came back from the ring. He called the drop kick, but he swiped off and didn't take it. Got his heat on me, did his fist, big elbow, spat on me after the match. But came back and he dropped Liz off the dressing room. They were in a separate room. And he came over and he found me. He came over to me and he started shaking my hand. And as he's shaking my hand, he's going, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And I said, Randy, that's not necessary. I said, that's what we're here for. He goes, and he jumped right up and looked me right in the eye. He goes, it is necessary. He said, always remember, kid, if you want to have a career in this business, always thank the guy that's putting you over, because he's allowing you to have that career. And I'd never forgotten that. Plus, the other guy that I mentioned, it's a huge intimidation factor. You know, we don't know anything. These are on TV every week and all the rest of it. But honestly, they were so cool. I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm sure there's probably one or two of the guys that were like pricks to us or anything. They were very welcoming, helped you out, and did all they could to try to minimize that intimidation factor. And that was, for a young kid like me, that was very well appreciated, you know, just to know that you're being sort of welcomed into this dressing room again, even though you don't know a thing. And then you learn from these guys, you watch them and you pay attention, and every night you're picking it up, you know, it was amazing.
My first week in the business, Vancouver, Canada, I walked in the dressing room 3 hours early because I didn't want to be late. Sitting there was a gentleman.
Well, things have changed.
Early now.
So I had to do it.
I walked in and there's this handsome man, tan, suit,
smoking a cigarette, reading the book. And I walked in and I said, oh God, I know that guy. So I walked over and it was, he got up, saw me, put a cigarette down and put it out and put his book down, walked over. He says, I'm Jack Briscoe, NWA World Heavyweight Champion. I said, yes, you are. And I went to give him my name. He says, I know who you are. He said, you know who I am? He goes, anybody beat up Billy Robinson? I got to know who that is. I had a little scuffle with Billy Robinson in my training camp, so I kind of got the best of Billy. He probably could have kicked my butt any other day, but that day he got on the wrong side of me. But
yeah.
Anyway, so Jack says, are you here for a while? I said, this is my first night. He said, well, I'm here for a week. You mind if I ride with you? And I said, well, I've got a pickup truck. He goes, that's even better. You got some country music in that truck. I said, yes, I do. And for the whole first week of my career in the business, I'm riding with Jack, driving Jack Briscoe, and he's giving me all this advice.
Wow.
The one piece of advice he told me was, consider this your business. And he pointed at my chest. He said, this is your business. Don't abuse it. Because if you don't take care of your business, you don't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
So I always kept that in my mind, and I tried as best I could not to get too far on the other side of the business. And, that was the best advice I ever got.
Any other questions? This gentleman right here.
I was just wondering, who was your personal favorite opponent? Basically, a question for all three of you, your favorite personal match that each one of you had, and I wonder if it aligns with what fans would call out as the highlight match.
That's always, people ask that, it's really hard for me because working with those guys, as I mentioned a second ago, was just like a kid to candy store. That you're amazed that these guys are working with you. Later, as you start to acclimate into the business and learn your craft a little better, and for me, that would come around the time of ECW, where I was first time being a heel. And I got an angle with Terry Funk, which, sitting in the learning tree, right? It was incredible. But there's always a difference. Like Sabu, amazing, because just wind him up and let him go. I mean, every fan knew what he could do. So as a heel, just cut him off, just cut him off, just cut him off. And when the crowd thinks they're not going to get it, the exact words I'd say to him, hit your shit, big boy, and boom, he exploded the place. Taz was great because he had that amateur's background, that style. I was always better with the guys that could throw me. I felt more at ease. And like Anthony the Randy Pitbull too, I consider those matches the best of my career because I was completely at ease with him because he listened to me and he'd be pressing me over his head. If you watch closer, you see my lips move because I'm upside down taking the bump. I'm telling him to beat his chest. He's not even, he's just doing what I'm telling him to do. And it was so much easier. But ECW, we had that sort of camaraderie that I'd never seen in the business prior, and I haven't seen it in the business since. But it was what I'd always heard Dominic and Bruno talk about when they were training us. The camaraderie of the boys and that sort of fraternity side. And wrestling had gotten pretty cutthroat by the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s. A lot of politicking and stuff, which always turned me off to the business. I had no, my feeling was always, if you're better than me in the ring, you should have the spot. And I'm going to work harder to try to get it back from you. We've all heard guys, we walk into a building and say it's half full. And you'd hear your opponent say, just take it easy, it's half full tonight. I don't mean this in any kind of trait way or self-serving way, and certainly not condescending to the other guys. I didn't know how to go half pace. I only do one speed, and it would throw me off to try to slow that down or whatever. So I just didn't like the gravitating of those guys doing it. My feeling was, if we do that, it might be a quarter field the next time. Let's tear it down, and everybody goes, shit, I missed a great show, you know? And that came, I always tell people, use this phrase, and I don't want to keep putting Sarge over because he's a great guy. I'd love to be 20 years old again. I'm thankful to God that I was 20 when I was 20, because if you just imagine those dressing rooms we were sitting in, the first night Mick and I ever did a show outside of Dominic's school, we looked at each other and said, what the hell are we doing here? How did we get into this room? Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys have forgotten more than we knew. But it's the favorite thing, as far as the Mount Rushmore thing, right? Because he's on Mount Rushmore with you. Well, I'm not. I could name 50 other names that would be up there. We had a real gem in ECW, but for me, it was at that point in my career, 12, 13 years in the business, always babyface, and the babyface thing was becoming boring to me. Like I could do it in my sleep. I didn't really have to think about it. So suddenly, when I became the heel, my initial thought, and this will show you how green I was at it, was just do the opposite of babyface. And there's a little more to calling the match and doing all of that. But there was always a willingness in the ECW dressing room to go out and tear it down. I'd never seen before or since anybody watching the matches, and when you come back, get a standing ovation. And in turn, the first time I saw Sabu hit the triple jump moonsault, I'm watching the monitor, and I'm like, what's he doing? He slides on, gets a chair, the guy's like, he sets the chair, but he's running away from it. What the hell is he doing? He jumps onto the chair, and he jumps on the top rope, and the moonsault's over the chair, on. I jumped out, I exploded like a kid watching wrestling. You know, like as if your baseball player just hit a grand slam. I'd never seen that before. It was so astounding and so elegant looking, but still looking rough, raw, just gritty. And then of course, he'd sell his own stuff. And I'd never seen heels do that. You know, so it was the complaint we'd always hear from non-wrestling fans was, oh, come on, if a 250-pound guy jumped on that top rope, he'd kill you. Well, yeah, but why does he sell? The guys before would just get up and do their hands or pop the crowd. Sabu would roll off selling his ribs. I thought, man, that looks so real to me. You know, it was, again, there was an elegance in the chaos that was Sabu's ability. I don't know that there's no way I can narrow down to one. I've had dozens of guys that I had great matches with and worked hard for me. So,
and just for the record, I don't sell shit. Just kidding. Sarge knows.
I know that.
I come back from the match, he's like, you got to sell stuff. Like, man, I'm too close to Detroit. I can't sell.
Sarge, he's prima donna.
No, my favorite opponent to work with, there's so many throughout your career and layers of your career, but I would say Sabu was always great because I learned a lot from him in the ring. You know, and then working with Edge and Christian. So there's a lot of defining moments of your career, but so many people get in the ring with and work with. It's just, you know, memorable to yourself and hopefully memorable to a lot of other people. But yeah. What about you, Sarge?
Well, I have so many great opponents, and there are many in your era that I would like to have Sabu.
Right,
I would love to have some matches with him and Randy Savage. I never got to wrestle Randy other than Battle Royal.
Really? Crazy.
But I'd probably say probably Pat Patterson.
They were the boot camp mats, right?
Valley Flight. Yeah.
Break the cover close, baby.
Yeah. And got the hard way in a post.
At the
Madison Square Garden. It was one of those matches where there was no rules, no time limit. You could wear whatever you wanted. No referee. That was the big thing was there was no referee. And as you guys know, it's tough to have a match without a referee stopping you from what you're doing as a villain. But we kind of pulled it off, but we didn't know exactly how to end the match until I was bleeding to death. My manager, my general, Ernie Roth, he came out and threw a towel in because he thought I was bleeding to death. Yeah. And I looked at him. I said, no. I'm climbing. I want to get back in. But that made Sergeant Slaughter the toughest SOB to everybody that ever watched that match. They said, that son of a bitch was still wanting to fight. And they threw the towel in on him. And of course, the Iron Sheik having boot camp matches with him. And I guess some of my all-time favorites were tag matches with Don Granolo, myself, against Ricky Steamboat, Jay Youngblood. Mm-hmm. And we did some phenomenal matches and matches that were never seen before. We had tag matches in a cage. That never happened. You never had a tag match in a cage, but we pulled it off. And we just had some phenomenal matches. There's guys like Stan Hansen, who I wrestled a few times and I never wanted to wrestle again. Because Stan was blind.
Yeah.
You'd be talking to him in the dressing room and they'd say, okay, you guys are up. And he'd take his glasses off and he'd start feeling his way around.
That's
the first time I ever wrestled Stan was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And 2 minutes into the match, he clotheslined the referee, thought it was me. So he referee had to disqualify him because per guy you went by the rules. You know, you don't touch a referee. So I got to scramble and fight him for another 15, 20 minutes without a referee. I mean, he about killed me. Yeah. And the worst match I think I ever had was with Mills Mascaris.
Oh.
Because all he did was pose. No matter what you did to him, he would pose. Pose and pose. I said, Jesus.
Good pose.
Horrible yeah. match. But I can't really say I've had a worse match than that. But I always figured every opponent was my favorite match because I gave it everything I had. And every match I had, that people say, what was your greatest match? I said, the last one.
Yeah.
I was in the Pittsburgh Civic Arena the night you wrestled Pat Patterson in the boot camp match.
Yeah.
I'd never seen, later that would have been called a hardcore match, right?
Right.
They were fighting all over the building.
Yeah.
He bled like a stuck pig.
Yeah.
And I mean, just the energy in the room was so, you could just feel it, you know? It was a young kid sitting there watching, I mean, it was like hook, line, and sinker pulled in.
Yeah. Mick Foley was in the third row of that match that night. And he said that sold him. He wanted to be a professional wrestler because he saw all the blood.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of Mick Foley, and you mentioned Mount Rushmore. I come up with my Mount Rushmore because it's hard to, but is Mick Foley, Mankind, Cactus Jack.
All four of them.
Yeah. I was overseas in Italy, and they asked me that, and I started with Mick Foley and then went to Cactus Jack. And they knew where I was going, and they started popping everything.
Well, Sarge, can I ask a question that I've always had as a kid? You left the WWF at the time because of the G.I. Joe deal, and then they kind of tried to create a facsimile of you and Corporal Kruschner. What were your thoughts on that action that Vince took to kind of, for lack of a better term, with all due respect, try to create his own, quote-unquote, Sergeant Slaughter?
Yeah, well, when I left the WWF at that time, I was so pissed off, I never watched the show.
Okay.
So for 6 years, I heard of Corporal Kirshner, but I never saw anybody wrestle for 6 years. And then when my contract was over, I decided to watch the pay-per-view WrestleMania 6 with Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. And that was the first time I had seen it in 6 years, and when I saw it, I couldn't believe the production.
Mm.
It was, when I left, they had maybe four cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Now they had about 20 to 30 cameras. It looked like a million people were in that Toronto dome. And I took out a piece of paper. Vince and I were like enemies, and I took out a piece of paper in the hotel desk, and I, "Dear Vince, just watched your WrestleMania 6. Got to take my hat off and give you a salute. Hollywood could take some lessons from your production." And I signed it. And then I put P.S., the match between the Warrior and Hogan, I put two big letters, P.U. I addressed it. I sent it to him. And about a week later, I'm watching a NASCAR race on a Sunday, half falling asleep, and I get a phone call. "Hello, Vince Art?" "Yeah, Vince." "Oh, hey, Vince, how you doing?" He said, "I got your letter, got your note. I appreciate your feedback on the production. Coming from you, that means a lot. Kevin Dunn and I and Kerwin, we've been working hard on making our product even better." And he said, "You're right about the match. I got an idea. You ready to go back to work? I see your contract's up with Hasbro." And I said, "Funny you should know that." He goes, I need to know those things."
Oh, wow.
So he says, "I got an idea for WrestleMania 7, maybe at my house." And of course, that's when the shit hit the fan. And I thought, when I left home, I told my wife, I said, "Vince is going to make me the real, real, real American hero." So I pull up and he says, "Hey, Sarge, like we'd never missed a beat." Gave me a hug and hands me a water, of course. And we go into his house, we go into the library, and there's a prototype of WrestleMania 7 at the LA Coliseum. He said, That's WrestleMania 7, 104,000. I want you and Hogan to sell it out. I said, me and Hogan? He said, yeah. I said, oh, I thought you wanted me to be the hero. How are you going to make Hogan the villain?
He was thinking NWO before NWO.
Completely opposite. He said, I want you to be the villain. You're going to come back. You're going to be mad at your country, at your military, because they let a little country like Iraq take over Kuwait, and you know they're kicking everybody's ass, and you're coming back mad as hell. I said, okay. 104,000, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So, but I never got there, unfortunately. I got stabbed 4 times, got shot. Battery acid thrown on me. I still have burn marks from it all over my body and maced every time I went to the ring. And, and a couple rental cars destroyed. And I could go through the whole thing, but we don't have enough time for it. But
did you get the insurance on the rental cars?
The unfortunate thing was Vince calls me again on a Sunday. Sarge, yeah, Vince. Yeah, I got that. I got it. Vince, what's going on? He said, change of plans. We're not going to the Coliseum now. I said, why? He said, well, they want $5 million because there's so many death threats and bomb threats. And I'm not paying $5 million to secure the Coliseum. We're going indoors. I said, but that's why I did this. That's why I got stabbed. That's why I got... He said, well, I'm sorry. And, of course, we had the biggest pay-per-view for a couple of years. I got a nice check out of it, but it would have been nicer to have that 104,000 next to your name. It's sold out there. But I found out later that Hogan's the one that asked me, or asked Vince to bring me back.
Okay.
He wanted a rematch with Warrior. And Hogan said, no way, I'm not wrestling him again. Said, well, then you either got Earthquake or Tugboat. He said, bring Slaughter back. So that's how I got back.
Any other? We have time for a couple more questions. Go ahead.
Rhino, you have the boar, but who do you think has the best spear?
Oh, that's a good question. Bron Breakker has a hell of a spear. So Edge and Roman, you know, a lot of people. So it's funny, Sarge, you probably, in chain, you probably haven't heard this one, but. Chris Van Vliet is he's got a podcast, really good dude, and he interviewed me, and he goes, I said something, I go, you know, no one's ever kicked out of the spear. And right when I said that, his wheels were turning in his head, like, no, he's trying to think, he's like, I swear I've seen someone kick out of the gore and all that stuff. And right when I gave it a pause, and I seen him thinking, and I go, yeah, if they kick out, it's the spear. Yeah. Totally popped. And what's funny is a couple times people would kick out, you know, shortly after that interview dropped, and you'd hear some fans go, spear, that was a spear. And I'd kind of laugh inside. Yeah. So I'm like, they heard the interview. Yeah. So. But yeah, there's so many great men and women, I think, you know, do the spear. You know, so I'm just fortunate Paul gave it a different name. So.
Any other questions there? Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to ask about injuries received from fans. Because I watched the Joe Rogan episode with Jake the Snake Roberts, and how he got cut with a box cutter from that 70-year-old grandmother.
Yeah.
And Tom Slaughter told me about all his stuff, and I've had a few of those.
Yeah.
Not shot though, but I came really close though. But Shane and Rhino, have you ever got attacked by fans?
Yeah.
When we those 70-year-old ladies, they get you every time.
Like Brian did a pour off me, right?
Yeah.
No, the scariest thing for me was not so much the fans that done something, but they tried. When we did the Halo thing with Gary Wolf, where I threw him down with the Halo, he had been seen around Philadelphia for 3 months. That thing was screwed into his skull, right? So the fans all knew it was legitimate. And I think they thought either he pushed too far, I took it too far, or Paul wrote it too far. And where the scary part came in is that
as a younger guy in the business, you know, comparatively speaking, at that point, I'd heard Terry Funk and all these old timers talk about white heat. And I started getting to the point where I got, come on, these old guys are putting themselves over, right? The fans know it's a work and they get round into it or whatever until that night. And Franny had been bumped during the match and she's laying face down, eyes closed, has no idea that this is going on. If you look at my face, I was taught to gauge by sight and then sound. So the sight was everybody collectively gasped like, oh my God, when I grabbed him. And then slowly they sort of morphed and the fangs started coming out. And I see fans to my stage left, my right, jumping the railing. My thought was to jump out, get Franny, and get the hell out of there. So as I jump out, just by tendency being right-handed, I grabbed and jumped out and turned me back to where Francine was. And as I'm turning around, I see somebody coming up really fast, and I swung and hit like right here. It was Todd Gordon. I hit him, and I looked up and I saw a guy come around the corner in head-to-toe riot gear. Paul Heyman, whose mother told me, if his lips are moving, he's telling you a lie. That's what his mother told me. So he'd always tell me and Franny, if you see cops in riot gear, you're in imminent danger. Well, you're in the building all damn day. They don't see a cop, let alone one in riot gear, right? Two of them. First guy came around, and that was when my heart first sunk because I'm expecting somebody got a gun to my head or something. And Tommy had pulled the two curtains back so you could see from the ring right into the dressing room. And Tommy Dreamer had a look on his face as if somebody had a gun to my head. So the guy behind me pushed my head down. The second guy grabbed me by the hair. I'm bent, and I grabbed Franny going by, but they're moving me so quick I can't get her feet up under her. Meanwhile, I'm getting uppercutted, kneed, and kicked. So I forced my head up just to stop getting hit. And that's when the fans started coming after us. It was like a wave. And they were pushing us right through the dressing room. And I looked at Big Dick Dudley and I said, he is help, he is help, he is help. And my driver had gotten the car started and was waiting for us, knowing that we had to get out of there quickly. The only problem is in Cadillacs and Lincolns, when you put the car in drive, it locks the doors. So I get there, the door's locked. I mean, open the door, and I throw Francine in and we're peeling out. And for some reason in all that chaos, Terry Funk came to my mind. And he said that you won't know till after if you've been cut. And he was, the match he hadn't used him with, I think, Pepper Gomez. He sees a guy like just go like that as he's walking by and didn't think anything of it. Looked down, he thought he was pissing his pants. So he looked down and his guts were hanging out. And so I went, I expect to see a knife here, a bullet wound here. And I asked Fran, do you see any blood anywhere? And you know, it just began like an ordeal. We had to be snuck into and out of the buildings in the trunks of cars. My wife that night got a death threat on the phone. She knew better than to say I wasn't home. Somebody called, said it was me, hung up, called back a few minutes later and said, I recited our address, told her he knows where we live, and that he's going to burn our effing house to the ground with us in it. Well, we sort of like laugh at that, taking it seriously, but, you know, okay, sure, something to burn a house down. My wife, ex-wife, took it really serious. You know, she's home 28 days a month by herself. So we had to get the alarm put in, got the dogs, bought a gun. And the funny part is, even when I'm on the road, you stand a better chance with me because I was an okay shot. She'd been hunting since she was a kid. She could hit the ass on a flea at 100 yards. So I told her, I said, if I ever come home early, I'll yell. As soon as I open the door, I'll yell, it's me, car. If you don't hear that, we're on the first floor right down from the kitchen. I said, just take the gun out, aim for the head, pull the trigger, get a knife, put it in his hand, call the cops. When you start having conversations like that with your wife or your kids, it takes on a different air. Again, we live with this kind of stuff every day, so you don't really think it's going to happen or that you're too worried about it happening. But when you're gone 28 days a month and your family's completely unprotected, it's hard for us to do anything from California. I'm in Pittsburgh, right? And so we started taking that stuff pretty seriously, but that was the closest. I had a couple fights with fans and stuff, but that was just, you know, my character doing that and having to defend my. If I went out there and got my ass beat by a fan, it wouldn't look very good, would it? So, and one time, I for some reason, popped in my head. I was going to tell you, I hope I'm getting a joke out of this. You know, during the course of a match, you get all that phlegm built up, right? And this match in ECW, and I hear out of all the voices, I can hear this one guy relentlessly the entire, you suck, you're a shitty, and it's going on and on and on. As I'm leaving the ring, he's the only guy saying anything now. He's right by the post, by the bottom of the stairs. So I pulled all that phlegm up, and I swear on my mother and father's grave, I meant to spit past him. And as I spit, it came out, and it started like spitting in there and it's growing as it's coming out. And smacked him in the eye and went, like, hung like this. And I went, I totally broke here. I went, oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Jesus. All right, on that note.
Well, no, go ahead. So I can answer that.
Sure.
No, because I've always been a great baby face and the fans have always loved me. So they've never tried to attack me.
With that,
I'm sitting up here with a bunch of heels.
Yeah. Would you like to run down real quickly, gentlemen, where folks can follow you online?
Yeah.
No, I don't really.
Okay.
Social media. Talk to Gary. He'll tell you. So Gary runs the social media.
I don't have time.
Okay.
I was up till 4 o'clock this morning answering people from yesterday and it's hard to keep up with all that.
Okay.
You know where you can find Sergeant Slaughter? USA.com.
Sharon, how about you?
There is a Twitter account that I started, X account that I'd started years ago, and a Facebook account at the Franchise SD and SDD Franchise at gmail.com was the Facebook page. Both of them have gotten hijacked. Yeah, I don't know if I've ever told you this story. My manager, Chris, calls me Moose. And he said, what the hell are you posting on social media? I said, I haven't been on social media in months. He goes, there's a picture. So I go to my site, I pull it up. It's like a dude like in leather all bound up and shit. Like a pump. What the
hell? I told you I never post those pictures.
So I tried to recover it, and I couldn't recover it. It'd been hijacked. So that's not me on there.
Mine's pretty simple. It's RHYNO.FU.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a round of applause to these talented individuals.
I'm going to interrupt my conversation just for one moment to talk to you about World's Greatest Comics. They are your one-stop shop for all your comic book related needs. They've got single issues, graphic novels, collections, toys, collectibles, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues. You name it, they got it. If you're in Central Ohio, you need to stop by the store. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. You can also follow them online. WGComics.com is a web address, and they're pretty active on the Facebook page. Just look for at WG Comics. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversations with the War Machine Rhino, the Franchise Shane Douglas, and WWE Hall of Famer Sergeant Slaughter. I hope you enjoyed those conversations, and maybe you want to let me know about it. Well, you can drop me a line a couple different places. First of all, you can shoot me an email at johnorlando@pvdcast.com, which is my email address. You can drop me a quick message over on Facebook, Instagram, or Threads. Just look for @PVDcast. And I'm still on Twitter. You can find me on my personal Twitter handle, which is @PVDMVP. Now, maybe you want to let some folks know about the show and where they can hear it. Well, there's a couple different avenues for that as well. First off is PVDcast.com, the online home of yours truly. But it's also available through all those major podcasting outlets. All you have to do is go to the search bar in your favorite outlet or app, put in PVDcast. Sometimes you have to put my name after it. And you should find it. And while you're listening through that outlet or app, please rate and review as it helps me out in the algorithm. And don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss an episode of the PVD cast. But there's one other way that you can hear the show, and that is every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I do a live broadcast through the Facebook page. Once again, it's @PVDcast. So there you go, three simple ways to hear the show, pvdcast.com, through your favorite podcasting outlet or app, and of course, Wednesday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time through the Facebook page. All right, ladies and gentlemen, with that, I'm going to get on out of here. I want to thank you once again for checking out the episode, and thank you for everything that you have done for the PVDcast. I feel like I need to say that one more time. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, and stay safe and healthy. been a presentation of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2020.